The social media app Twitter has undergone some big changes since Elon Musk completed his purchase of the company late last month. Well over half of its workforce was either laid off or resigned. Reports say some of the platform's largest advertisers have left since Musk's takeover. He's made a push to promote what he deems as free speech by reinstating accounts that had been previously banned under content moderation policies. If you don't use Twitter, you might wonder, so what? But at many points, what happens on Twitter can influence politics here in the U.S. and around the world. And it all raises questions about what exactly free speech means on any social media platform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use Twitter? What do you think of what Elon Musk has done so far with the platform? Did you try Twitter at some point and say, it's not for me? Are you looking for an alternative at this point? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Kaye is a professor at the University of California Irvine School of Law. He's the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Freedom of Opinion and Expression, and he's the author of the book Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, let's start with the why might people care even if they don't use Twitter? A lot of people don't use Twitter. It's smaller than the Facebooks and TikToks of the world. Why does what happens on Twitter, if at all, matter outside of Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter has had, and you're exactly right, because it's a smaller platform, much, much smaller than Facebook or YouTube or some other sites. But it has this massive kind of influence, which I think is driven largely by the people who are using the site. So it has become, over time, a major site for journalists, a major way in which governments around the world, including the United States, get their message out. It's almost like a bulletin board for public policy, for reporting, for connecting communities. And in that sense, it's got this influence that gives it an unusual kind of power. And I think in some respects, that's why people are generally, pretty upset about the changes that have been taking place there, because people are worried that kind of space for journalism, space for community, space for engagement is at some kind of risk.
I think back to 2011 here in Wisconsin, we had the Act 10 law in the state, protests at and inside the state capitol. That's when I first started to see Twitter being used by the left and the right, each in their own ways, and kind of inventing hashtags as that way to keep track of what's happening right now. People are trying to do that with protests in China, as we speak, probably. That seems like one of the most significant impacts of Twitter, with people following that breaking news, the things that are happening at this moment.
I think that's absolutely a big part of it. And it's a big part of it for a number of reasons. I mean, one is it allows for people to share what they're doing and to share what they're seeing, which, of course, as we saw, as far back as 2011, whether it was in the Arab Spring or in the context that you just described, we saw that people organized around what they saw online. So in other words, they would see something online, they would share something online, and it would have impact on the ground. In other words, people would take that and they would go to protest. They would go to the street. They would go to, their state capitol building and conduct protests. So that kind of interaction was definitely a kind of a part of the early attraction and the early influence. The problem is that at that time, in the early years of Twitter, it was also a place for, a lot of bullying and harassment. And Twitter really took a long time to figure out, can they do both things? In other words, can they be both a place for community and for organizing on the left and the right? And at the same time, can they deal with harassment and, the kind of sort of racist or anti-Semitic or Islamophobic kind of content that would push people off the platform? It was a pretty big challenge for the company for a long time.
And now here's Elon Musk, owner of Tesla and SpaceX, among other companies, now owner of Twitter. What have you seen him change when it comes to answers to that question you just raised?
Well, I mean, what Elon Musk has been doing, I think, has to be broken up into pieces because different things that he is doing is having different kinds of effects. So for one thing, like people who are, you know, ordinary users, all the way up to power users, you know, the people who tweet or retweet or like everything, one of the things that they may be seeing right now is that the platform is just slower. And in part, that's because Elon Musk has fired most of the staff who do everything from high-level policy all the way to software engineers who kind of keep the place running. So he's had this massive firing of people. He's had particularly kind of a major effort to let people go in the Twitter offices around the world. So, you know, at least as far as the actual working of the platform goes, I think people are going to start to see, if they haven't seen already, a little bit of a slowdown. But when it comes to these other things, you know, being a space for community, for protest, for sharing of information, I think we have two possibilities. I mean, one is because Elon Musk has basically said, you know, I'm going to let everybody or pretty much everybody who was kicked off the platform at some point and was kicked off even though they didn't break any law, but they broke some Twitter rules, he more or less announced an amnesty and he's going to let those people back on. You know, most of those people are unknown to the vast majority of the public, but some are pretty well known, like Donald Trump. And there will be others like that. And the risk of doing that is that by opening up to all of those people who previously were, you know, basically deplatformed because of racism or harassment or bullying or, you know, you name it, some violation of the Twitter guidelines, the Twitter rules, it's going to make it harder for people who just want to use the platform for community to use it. Because instead of finding community, they're going to find potentially, you know, what it used to be, which was a kind of, you know, it was described as a kind of cesspool of bad content, of harassment and so forth. That's the risk. And that's what really could come to pass if he follows through with this idea of opening it up to all these kinds of users who abused the platform in the past.
We're talking to University of California Irvine Law Professor David Kay about changes to Twitter, how they can affect the world outside of the social media platform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the story since Elon Musk bought Twitter, the changes he's making? Do you support some of the things he's done? Do you have worries? Do you have questions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with David Kay, free speech expert, law professor at the University of California, Irvine. With us today, looking at what Elon Musk has done as owner of Twitter, what his changes could mean, even for people who don't even use the social media platform. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. Just have a few minutes if you do want to join in. What do you see these changes doing to impact the future of Twitter, David? We've seen a lot of advertisers say, well, we're going to hold off at least. We don't want our ads popping up next to, say, some kind of anti-Semitic tirade.
That's exactly right. I mean, so there's a few different ways in which this could unfold. Like if it unfolds in the most negative ways for the platform. I mean, one is as Elon Musk opens it up to, you know, the kinds of content that I think has been troubling to many, many people in the past. One possibility is advertisers flee. And when advertisers flee, that's simply going to make it harder for Twitter to sustain itself. It has a huge amount of debt to service. It has to be, you know, it has to be kind of a going concern in order to be available to people. So that's one possibility. The other possibility that has kind of become a little bit more evident to people over the last couple of weeks is that, you know, the places where people get Twitter often is on their mobile devices. So their iPhone or their Android. And those, let's call them gatekeepers, you know, companies like Apple, that operate the App Store, they have their own rules. And if they find that the platform is being used to disseminate white supremacist content, racist content, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-LGBTQ kinds of content, as that increases, those gatekeepers are going to be more and more concerned that they are hosting a site that allows that to happen, and they could clamp down. In fact, you know, even potentially making Twitter unavailable for updates and for new users to download the app. So there's all sorts of ramifications here from Elon Musk's new approach, or the approach that he's bringing to Twitter, that could over time really undermine the platform and the platform's ability to do what it's supposed to do.
We just have a minute or so left, David. What a lot of questions up in the air. What are you watching for next?
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in to see is of course what Apple and what advertisers do. But I'm also especially interested to know what foreign governments are going to do, because, you know, we're having this conversation, and not just you and me, but others within the United States, we're having this conversation about the impact on users in the US, but the vast majority of Twitter users are actually outside the United States. And it could be in a variety of ways that as the content rules change, as there are fewer people to actually determine which content should come down, which users should be deplatformed, governments are going to be increasingly concerned with that. And they are going to make demands that Twitter do certain things that would really fundamentally be against sort of norms of freedom of expression, norms of protest and right to protest, and all of that. So I would be looking especially outside the United States to see how governments actually deal with this particular set of problems that Elon Musk seems to be setting up for us.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to talk with you.
That's David Kaye, law professor from the University of California, Irvine, author of the book Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. With us today to look at the impact Elon Musk has had on Twitter and how it can affect people beyond just those who use the social media platform. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's expected that Wisconsin will see a $6.6 billion budget surplus next year, according to a release last week from the governor's office. That would be a record high. The question now, what to do with that money? The governor, state lawmakers, and others have lots of ideas, including big changes to the tax system, funding for schools and local governments, and more. Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning in the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, you've been watching the state budget process for years and years now. What do you think led to this situation of this unprecedented projected budget surplus?
Rob, I've got to tell you that in terms of the macro economy, that it's just sort of pure luck. Wisconsin can't be in prosperity when the rest of the country is in a recession or vice versa. Our tax system is very much reflective of economics. And so when the economy is good, people buy things and they pay sales taxes. When the economy is good, people make more money and they pay more income taxes. So that's the reason for the surplus this time. And that's the reason we've had surpluses in the past. And I'm old enough to remember all kinds of inevitable cycles of surplus deficit. And so I hope that the legislators and the governor won't be like sort of kids in a candy store where the money feels like it's burning a hole in their pocket. And I hope they'll take a longer term view about what to do with that surplus.
Right. I have dim memories as well of the 1990s. You had a Republican governor, Tommy Thompson, Democratic controlled legislature. There was a surplus. The governor wanted to cut taxes. Democrats and legislature wanted to make investments. They said, yeah, we got money for both. They did both. And then the economy changed and we had some tight, lean times.
Rob, good for you for remembering that. In fact, I'd like to add to that because you're just a kid. I was in the state legislature. I was in the state legislature in the 70s and 80s, and in 1978 there was a governor's race and there was a surplus, and Governor Marty Schreiber suggested dealing with it prudently, but the Republican candidate for governor, Lee Dreiffus, said, "Give it back. It belongs to the people." And he got elected, and as governor, the first thing he did was giving it back. And what do you know, within his 4-year term, there was a deficit. And he had to ask the legislature to pass an increase in the sales tax for a fifth cent as a temporary way to solve the deficit. And so from your memory, Rob, and from my memory, it just seems to me that we need to remember the past. We need to remember that a surplus is a temporary thing. It's not permanent. It's not going to last forever. And we should be prudent with it in the same way that people are when they get an unexpected revenue benefit.
All right, let's check out some of the ideas on the table. Now, Governor Evers has said, let's do some more targeted tax cuts, mainly toward the middle class. Republicans have said, let's think big, maybe do something like get rid of the income tax. Or there was talk of a flat tax coming into the election cycle. What kind of tax changes, if any, would you be looking for?
Well, the lesson we learned from the Tommy Thompson story that you talked about is that there's a difference between a one-time tax cut, in other words, sending people a check, versus a permanent tax cut, which means a change in the rate you pay or you know, whatever relevant criterion there would be. Tommy was smart enough to focus on a one-time rebate where he sent people checks in the mail. It was very much like what happened during COVID in the federal government. And so that prevented a permanent deficit. But nonetheless, I think that what happened with Tommy and what happened with Governor Evers, these were bad ideas. And if you talk to any financial consultant who deals with individuals, the lesson is always save, save, save. Save for a rainy day. And right now, Wisconsin has a legally required budget stabilization fund, but it's infinitesimal. It's like about $1 billion. And believe it or not, in state budgets, $1 billion is chump change. It's not much money. If anything, it seems to me no tax cuts, no rebates, increase the rainy day fund, and perhaps pay down the debt. Wisconsin has a huge debt that it pays. And we all know that if you prepay a mortgage debt, you benefit from it. Why can't we talk about things like that?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gail is on the line in Madison. Gail, hi.
Hello. I've been listening to the Democrats say we should provide, you know, middle-class tax cuts, and the Republicans talking about a flat tax. And one of the things that I don't hear people saying is if you cut the rate for the middle class, say the 20,000 to 100,000 range, everybody who makes more than 100,000 gets that tax cut. So it isn't just for, you know, lower moderate income people. It's for everybody. I like the idea that Professor Lee just mentioned about paying down some of the debt because,
Gail, I gotcha. Thanks for that call. Is that how tax cuts work, Mordecai? It works like the graduated tax levels. Everybody gets that cut up to that certain point?
Right. That's a really important point that Gail made. Sometimes you hear the phrase the marginal rate, mm-hmm. the marginal tax rate. And that's indeed the case, that income that goes over blankety blank, let's say, as she used the example, $100,000, gets taxed at a rate that's higher than up to $100,000. And so when Republicans want to stimulate the economy and they say, let's cut the marginal rate, what they're talking about is let's cut it for the people with the highest incomes who are, as you said, Rob, paying the most highest of the graduated rates. So it's important. It would be impossible to say, to somebody, you don't get it, even though you're making, let's say, up to 100,000 and beyond, compared to people who are up to 100,000.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the state's projected budget surplus next year. Mordecai, we've talked so far about the tax side of things. Let's talk about where money could be spent. Now, we've got one unit of government that's apparently flush with cash, the state government. We've got local governments and school districts having lots of referenda over the course of this year, sometimes just to meet basic operating expenses like local initiatives to help pay for, you know, EMS services and police services. Is there an argument to be made to give them a taste of this surplus?
Okay, Rob, I'm afraid we're going to have to do a history lecture, and I'll try to keep it down to 1 minute. At the beginning of the 20th century, Wisconsin passed a constitutional amendment to create an income tax, and that the income tax would be called shared revenue. And the sharing word was that state government would get about half and local governments would get about half. But local governments made the blunder of not getting it in writing. And so over the years, the state legislature has just sort of arbitrarily decided how much of shared revenue would go to, let's say, county government, city government, school boards, and how much they would keep. And it shouldn't surprise you that the state legislature usually decides to keep more and give less and less of shared revenue. And that's exactly what we're facing right now, that legislature has benefited from increasing in tax revenues, but has not shared it with local governments.
We heard from Tammy on email who says, what would be wrong with dividing, say, $5 billion of that surplus among the 72 counties? Have the counties take the money, invest it, and spend dividends on local needs, county needs, such as police and fire positions. So her solution, take this money, make, I guess, a foundation for local governments to have some guaranteed revenue from year to year.
Well, there's a precedent for that. I think it's called the Common School Fund. I might be wrong, but it's a kind of a place where money that has nowhere else to go ends up. And then the annual interest gets distributed, I think it is to public libraries. I think just in the last week or two, we saw a story about libraries got a bonanza because there was increased revenue for the Common School Fund. So what she's suggesting does have precedent. I'm sure they would fight over the details of it. But as individual citizens, we all know that if you invest a large amount of money and can live on the interest, that means the money is perpetual. It's indefinite. And it's a very worthwhile idea.
Another idea being floated, Governor Evers saying, as he does, put more money into schools, K through 12 schools. Republicans seem to be, at least some of them, open to the idea. Also calls for more funding for school choice programs. Where do you see education fitting into these questions, Mordecai?
Well, when you sit in the legislature and you look at either school boards or municipal governments, you think of them as just sort of spenders, almost like whiners. They always whine that they don't get enough money. But it was during Tommy's administration that he tried to set a policy that shared revenue that goes to school boards would cover between 2/3 and 3/4 of all school spending. And I'm afraid we've really lost that guidance, that guideline as sort of the principle for how to divide up the money. And I think it's perfectly justified if you look at the amount of money that school boards and local governments are getting versus, let's say, the inflation rate, that they've been losing money over the years. And the fact that they have to go to referendum just to cover operating expenses is understandable. And I would suggest trying to go back to Tommy's principle of about a 2/3 funding level from the state to school boards.
Do you think there's the, I guess, political will to tackle fundamental issues like that as opposed to, hey, let's play with this money?
You know, I'm afraid that when we sort of criticize the stock market and Wall Street, and we say that CEOs are making short-term decisions because they want to goose, let's say, the dividend or the value of their share, I think it's sort of inevitable that elected officials, politicians, especially members of the state legislature from whatever party, want to get the immediate benefit so the taxpayers will thank them in the next election, as opposed to future taxpayers 40 years from now kind of thing. And so there is a kind of a short-termism that pervades political decision-making about doing something that has instant results as opposed to long-term results.
Mordecai, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Glad to, Rob. Thank you.
That's Mordecai Lee, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's record-high $6.5 billion budget surplus expected next year and what, if anything, to do with it.